Big Adventures with Brian Durker is supported by Dave Wegner and dedicated to all the scientists and river community who have worked to protect the Colorado River, Grand Canyon, and its environment. Thank you, Dave, for your support of Big Adventures.
Thanks for stopping by today, you guys. Get comfortable. I've got a guest that has a remarkable story. I really love the arts, and this guy's an artist. Jose?
How are you doing, Brian?
I'm doing great. And I'm really excited to have met you just recently.
Yeah.
And I'm really excited to hear your story, just like everybody else. It's Jose Martinez. And let's start out. I mean, where were you born?
Well, I was born in Southern Cal, San Bernardino, and grew up in Upland, California. And then my father jumped around a little with his work, so we lived in Colorado for a short time when I was super young. And then we ended up in Williams. And so I went to high school in Williams, graduated from Williams High School.
Oh, wow.
And then...
local boy.
Yeah. And then... you know, went to college here in Flagstaff at Northern Arizona University.
And what line of work was your dad in?
Well, he originally, he was a head designer for Hooker Headers. So designing car headers for, I mean, he did production cars, race cars, boats,
oh, cool.
Dragsters, you know, everything. But he started out with Gary Hooker back in the 60s when it was like a five-man shop. And then Hooker Headers grew into a huge conglomerate, eventually was bought by Edelbrock. But he was with them off and on, you know, from the 60s or early 70s all the way up into the 80s, basically. And he hated being under a car. That was a problem. He was really good at what he did. But, you know, he was kind of a cowboy at heart. We always had animals and horses and cows and pigs and stuff. And he liked the outdoors. So any chance he could jump ship and get a different type of job, he would do that. So he was offered a job up in Colorado early on doing some kind of construction stuff. And then his father got sick with cancer and we picked up and moved back to California be close to his father, and then when his father passed away, we moved. We had some family move up here to Williams, and he's like, he loved it. He loved Williams.
It's a neat little community.
The high country, and back then there was no I-40. I think Route 66 still ran right through town, so all the traffic funneled through town. So it was really a fun town.
Yeah, it was a busy little spot for sure.
Yeah. And he took a job cutting timber, which was when the lumber mills were open here, and he was cutting pulpwood and stuff. But it was hard. It was hard work, and he, you know, in the winters it was brutal. You know, pretty much shut down. So we had family in California that had some big ranches, farming and dairy cattle. So he was offered a job with. One of my uncles offered him a job running this big ranch, 1,000-acre ranch in Southern Cal. So he took it, and we moved out
back to California.
And of all places, it was out near Barstow, out in the middle of the desert. It was miserable. I remember as a kid, we'd drive through Barstow, and I was like, God, this is a godforsaken place. I'd never want to live here. And sure enough, we ended up living there.
In Barstow
or outside of Barstow there, Newberry Springs.
Yeah, I can only imagine.
Yeah, it was horrible. But I really learned to love the desert. I mean, the desert had some beauty. So I made a lot of friends out there, and it was a fun place to live for a while.
And then... let's talk a little bit about Williams, high school in Williams.
Yeah.
I mean, I went to Flagstaff High School, so we're local boys, both of us. And Flagstaff was like the big city to you guys.
Yeah, it was. That was like the big, like, we're going to Flagstaff. That was the big outing.
I remember when I played football. Oh, I was playing JV football at the start of the season, and we played in Williams. The JV played the varsity because we were a bigger school and stuff. Yeah. We played the varsity for their homecoming.
Yeah.
But it was really cool. We won.
Yeah.
But it was a great, I've always loved Williams. It's a great little town.
Well, at that time the sports were huge. You know, I mean we had a game and everybody in town.
Well, that's what I
up.
Recalled. It was and it was the homecoming queen and the everybody was there.
Yeah, it was awesome. And the year I graduated in 83, my senior year there, we went 11-0. We were undefeated. We had a great team. And then we lost at state. We lost to one of those teams down south.
One of those brawny southern teams.
So, but it was really a fun time. I mean, the school was fun and, you know, it was a tight-knit community.
Do you remember the student body, how big Williams High School was?
I was only, my graduating class was, I think it was 47 kids.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was like 250, 300 kids maybe max for the whole high school.
Oh, that's a cool upbringing.
Yeah.
And did you guys have a house right in town?
And my dad was cutting pulpwood and I would go out with him and stack it. And, you know, we worked for the Forest Service a little bit. And yeah, it was... You know,
a small Western town upbringing there.
Yeah, I was down and dirty, but I loved it.
Yeah, no, that's cool.
And then Williams has a you know, you go up one side and down the other.
Yeah, they've got the one-way
loop.
Main street.
Yeah, one main street. And you could, so the big thing was to cruise, you know, when cruising was cool. So we would cruise up and down on the weekends.
Did your dad still have some cool cars and stuff like that you could cruise in? I can almost see this.
No, so he had an old Ford pickup and, I mean, he's had some cool cars over the years. I mean, back in the day, he was like a Hell's Angel, a biker, and he had bought an old cop three-wheeler Harley from the, you know, like an auction and turned it into a chopper. And he's got, they called it the rickshaw chopper. It looked like a rickshaw kind of, and they throw me in back of it. But he didn't have that when we were in Williams, but he's had cool cars over the years.
Yeah, cool.
An old 52 Ford he has right now that we have been working on for years. I don't know if we'll ever finish that.
Tell him I've got a 53 Chevy for him when he gets done with a 52 Ford.
So, but my grandmother or my grandfather had given me, I was 13, he gave me a Toyota Corolla and the transmission was broken in it. And my dad said, listen, if you can fix it, you can drive it. So at 13, I went down to the junkyard and found a transmission for a 69 Toyota Corolla, and I fixed that car and got it running, and I used to drive it to school from 13 on.
Those are the good old days.
Yeah. So, and I, you know, I tried to lower it and put mag wheels on. I tried to make that Corolla a hot rod. So it was silly, but.
That's great stuff. and then from Williams, where do you go?
So
to NAU?
From Williams, I started school at NAU. My parents actually moved back to California, and I stayed up here and went to college at NAU. And I thought I was going to be a teacher. I wanted to go into the teaching program at NAU. I got fourth grade student teaching and realized I don't want to be a teacher.
All it takes is a room full of fourth graders to drill.
I went into class and there was this little kid in there cussing at me. And I was like, I don't know if this is for me. So that was here in Flag. And I was kind of disillusioned. I wasn't a great student anyway. So I was a little disillusioned. And I met my wife. And she says, well, why don't you take some classes over here in the communications department? So that's what I did. I enrolled in some photography classes and was totally hooked. Got into the photography program here. Had some great mentors there, Gene Balzer, Chris Everett. And
And those are names I've heard.
Yeah. Gene was the dean of the communications department, I think, at that time. And they had a great program. I mean, it wasn't geared towards fashion, but it was just about photography. And it was a really good program. And my wife was a fashion merchandise in the fashion merchandising program. So we were, you know, I kind of got into fashion at that time, you know, through her, and then photography. And I thought, I want to be a fashion photographer. So that was kind of the career path I chose, and went to school and got my photography degree there.
So. And when you came out of school, were you able to land some work immediately, or did you develop some of it while you were in school?
So that's why I brought this book here. I was going to tell you the story.
Yeah, tell it.
I was, you know, back in that day, it was like you just wanted to get out of school and get a job. I mean, of course, I wanted to be a photographer, but I thought, you know, if the airlines hire me, I was working through school at Walgreens Distribution Center here when they were in town. And it was kind of a career job if you wanted it to be. You could work up the ranks there. You know, they had 401k, the whole kabang.
Good job.
Yeah, it was a good job for Flagstaff. So I thought, well, I can stay with them and get into their management program, or I can pursue photography. So I was getting ready to graduate. I was sitting in the NAU library, you know, doing some research on different companies that were coming in to interview. And this book right here, the Rolling Stone, the photographs with Tina Turner on it, was sitting on the counter in the library. And I started paging through it. And in the back of it, it has the bios of all the photographers that have shot covers for Rolling Stone magazine. And, you know, talked about where they lived and, you know, just gave a little synopsis about each photographer. And majority of them at the time were living in New York City. And I looked up and there was a row of phone books from this is before cell phones and internet. So I looked up and there's a row of phone books up there. And New York was right there on the shelf. So I'm like, what the hell? I'm going to look in the phone book and see if any of these guys' names are in the phone book.
Oh, you clever young graduate guy.
So I opened the phone book and sure enough, you know, Richard Avedon, Albert Watson, Steven Meisel, all these guys that were in this book were in the phone book, their phone numbers. So I wrote down all their numbers and I kind of contemplated it for a few days and I decided, you know, what the hell, I'm just going to call and see if they're, you know, I was getting ready to graduate. So I was looking to do something and I said, I'll call these numbers, see if they're taking anybody, assistants or, you know, if they needed help or apprentice, whatever. So I called Richard Avedon's studio. There's a guy in here named Hero. I called him. I called Albert Watson's studio. And they're like, yeah, if you're in town, you know, come by. We'll meet with you, you know, see how it goes. So I came home, or that night I told my wife, I said, listen, I got interviews in New York. I didn't, but I said, I got interviews in New York.
As good as an interview, you had the invite.
Yeah, and we had some friends that I just graduated with, or the graduated the year prior. They had just moved to New York, this a friend of mine, Sal. So I called her up. I said, listen, can I stay with you? I want to go through some interviews. I'm going to buy a plane ticket and come to New York and go through some interviews. And bought a plane ticket, took vacation off from Walgreens Distribution Center. Took all my vacation, 2 weeks of vacation, I think, and took off to New York. And then I just hit the pavement in New York City and started calling all these people as soon as I got there. Like, I'm in town. Can I come by and meet you? I met with Richard Avedon. I met with Albert Watson. I met with
Hero. So they were pretty cool. They were accessible.
They were accessible at the time. You know, it was still when people actually met with you, talked to you, answered the phone, or their office personnel would answer the phone. And, you know, these guys were pretty big time. Yeah. So, like, you could never do that now.
No. You can't get a hold of
anybody. You got to go through 10 people to get to anybody. Anyway, so they're like, yeah, if you're here, come by. We'll meet with you. So I met with all these people, and I met early, like first, second day I was there, I met with Albert Watson. And he said, him and his studio manager, and they said, listen, he had this beautiful studio down in the meatpacking district in New York, in the I think it's the West Village. I'm not sure. I can't remember for sure. I think it's the West Village. And he had bought the whole building, and the bottom half of the building was the studio, and the top half of the building was his apartment. And they were it was gorgeous, gorgeous studio. And they were redoing the floors in the studio. And he says, we're renting a studio, and we need a third assistant. And would you be willing to work this week? And I said, yeah, absolutely. So right. Now you have to remember, I'd never been to New York.
Yeah.
I just left NAU.
That must have been daunting.
I was a country boy. I'd never been, you know, in a big city like that or anything, you know. So it was really, it's like out of a movie, you know. I mean, I couldn't believe what was going on. I really was so naive. I didn't know, you know, the magnitude of
that's why it worked.
Yeah. So they said, you know, can you work? And I said, yeah. They said, well, come tomorrow morning. They gave me an address where they were going to be at. So I show up to this. It's rental studios in New York. So there's a bunch of studios in there, and there's a bunch of other photographers in there working. And we had one of the other studios. And when I showed up, I walked down the I'm walking down the hallway, and you can see names on the doors like Walter Chin, you know, Francesco Scavola. Like, there's all these
big
names.
You're in the epicenter.
Yeah, and I'm like, holy crap, this is, you know, this is really happening. And I get down. I still didn't realize what I was doing, you know, what I had just stepped into. And so I get into the studio. They're like, Albert shoots these very iconic pictures, portraits. He's mostly known for celebrity portraits and stuff. I'll show you this book here, but he's shot some amazing portraits that are very iconic. And but he was shooting a inside spread of a magazine, and they built this plexiglass studio. It was kind of elevated, and he used to shoot kind of low from the ground, shooting up on things. And so he said, "Listen," one of the other assistants said, You know, we're building this thing, and you're going to stand on the end there, and the model's going to jump. And your job all day is to make sure she doesn't fall off that stage. So you're catching models. So that was my first day of the job. The first time I ever assisted anything. I'd never assisted. I'd never been on a photo, like a real photo shoot or anything. And so I spent the whole day catching these supermodels. And it turns out it was a spread for American Vogue. And we were, you know, I was catching these models falling off the stage. And that was I got home that evening and called Gene Balzer, my professor here. And I said, you know, I can't believe I'm in New York. I'm assisting for this guy named Albert Watts. And I really didn't know who Albert was at that time, except for this picture I saw in this book. And I said, and I'm catching models all day. I said, this is awesome. I think this is what I want to do the rest of my life. I want to be a photographer if this is it. So anyway, I came back, and by the end of the week, they said, if you come to New York, we'll hire you on full time and, you know, in-house.
Oh, wow.
So I finished that job that week and came home, and I told my wife at the time, we were newlyweds, and I said, you know, I want to move to New York. I think I got a job out there. And knock on wood, she agreed to it. God bless her. And we quit our job. She had a full-time job as a visual merchandiser. I think she was either at Dillard's or JCPenney here in town. She was like a visual merchandising manager. And we both quit our jobs and moved to New York. We packed everything we had in a little Ford Ranger and a little 4x6 U-Haul at the time.
How exciting.
And moved to New York. And when I was in New York that week, my friend Sal said, go talk to our friend of ours across the street, this guy Sal Licata. He just bought this building, and he's gutting it, and he's going to have apartments in there, and maybe he'll have one for you. So I went and talked to him. He says, yeah. Granted, I walked into the building, and it was gutted. And I said, I'm coming back in about a month, month and a half, 2 months. And do you think you'll have an apartment here? And he says, yeah, pick one, whatever one you want. So this is in Brooklyn down in Carroll Gardens. And he says, pick one. So I said, well, I want the top floor. He says, all right, it's yours when you come back. So $750 a month, which is crazy.
Basically nothing.
Yeah,
in
New
town.
York City. So... we took that apartment and we moved. And I remember when we drove cross country and we were driving over the Verrazano Bridge into Brooklyn and from Staten Island, I think, and we're coming into the area of the neighborhood. And it was, you know, New York can be pretty gritty. The subways were all graffitied. It's pretty rough. And my wife just started to welt up and start crying. She's like, I think we've made a mistake. I think we've screwed up. And I said, no, it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. And we get to the apartment. And as we're walking up the stairs to the apartment, cells walking us up, they were literally hanging the door on the apartment, sawdust all over. And I thought she was going to lose it. I thought we were going to have to turn around and head back home because she was just, you know, everything was
stressed.
Yeah, just totally. It was just a big shocker. So, but we moved and we made it happen. I went to work for Albert. We worked on some amazing campaigns, got to meet a lot of fabulous movie stars and famous people, and that was kind of the start of my photo career.
And did you stay in that apartment for a long time?
We were there a couple years, so I stayed with Albert maybe just over a year or so, and then I left him and started freelance assisting different photographers. I assisted a guy named Michelle Comp and Patrick Anderson, also really well-known celebrity-type photographers. And they were shooting ad campaigns and other stuff. And then I was freelancing, assisting, and so it was kind of hit or miss. I was either really busy or not busy at all. So we were scrambling for money, trying to make ends meet back then. My wife had took a job. Her first job was with Vera Wang, which is a big wedding dress designer at the time.
Oh, cool.
Before Vera Wang blew up, she's huge now in the fashion industry. And she got a job working in their wedding studio, fitting brides, and then eventually did Vera's windows and then moved on. But, you know, trying to make ends meet there was tough. So I was offered a job as a photo editor for a publishing company there in New York on 53rd and Broadway, right across from David Letterman. I had an office there and I was offered a job with a publishing company there. They published an assortment of magazines, Shelter Division, like Country Accents, Country Victorian Accents, some Fit magazines and a few other things. And so I took that job and was a photo editor there. And then my wife had broke, it's a long story, but she had broke her leg, was kind of, you know, we're just kind of down in the doldrums and we're like, maybe we should regroup. You know, remember we were newlyweds, so like really stressful. And we were like, maybe we should move home and just kind of regroup. And home for us at that time was back to California. Her family was from California. So I had one more interview. I wanted to see if I still couldn't do photography or work in the photography industry, like as an assistant. So a friend of mine had said, listen, there, Annie Leibovitz is looking for somebody, like a third or fourth assistant. And this call this guy, I think his name was Mark, but don't quote me on that. I'm not positive on his name, but they said, go talk to him or give him a call and see if you can't get in there. So I called him up, and this is a sad story, but I called him up and I said, listen, I'm interested in this job if you guys are hiring. He said, yeah, we're looking for somebody. Why don't you come down and meet? So I went down to Annie's studio down in Varick Street and interviewed with him. I think I met Annie briefly, and then the interview went well, and I came out of there thinking, oh, I think I might get this job. Like, this might be it, you know. And she shot a specific camera at the time. I think she was shooting these RZ67 or RB, these giant Mamiya cameras. And a friend of mine said, listen, the Javits Center, they're having their photo convention. You should go down there and talk to the Mamiya guys and just go over that camera. Because I wasn't really familiar with that camera system. And not that she was going to let me touch the camera anyway, but I was probably...
The more you had under your... Oh, very interesting.
Yeah, there, I was like, well, I should be familiar with her camera system and know as much as I can. You know, that was kind of the as an assistant, that's your job. So besides lighting and everything else. And so I went down and met with the Mamiya guys at the Javits Center and was talking to him about the camera, and I told him, yeah, I think I might be working with Annie in, you know, for Annie. And they said, did you hear what happened? I said, no. And they said, well, Mark, the guy I just interviewed with, passed away last night. And I was like, what? And they're like, yeah, he passed away last night. I don't know the whole story. I don't know what happened. I don't know
what happened.
It was really sad. So I was like, you know, I think we better leave New York and regroup. I wasn't going to call the studio and still try and pursue this job. I mean, that's the guy I met with.
Like, get his job or something.
Yeah,
maybe
I mean, like,
too soon.
Yeah. So, and we were kind of at the end of our rope anyway. And I really didn't want to leave New York, but I thought it was the best thing for our marriage and just to kind of regroup. So we left New York and moved back to Southern California, down near kind of in the Ventura, Santa Barbara area, and got a place down on the beach and kind of regrouped. And I took a job as a photo editor for a publishing company in L.A., publishing like they used to publish. It was called Guest Informant, but they published like hotel books that you'd set in hotels. So I was doing research and finding photos and hiring photographers, and on occasion we'll go out and do a photo shoot for these publications that were all over the country. So
it was a pretty good job though.
Yeah, I mean, it was okay. It wasn't, I wanted to be a photographer, but it was still in the realm of what I wanted to do. So so that's, I took that job. But the key was, we were living on the beach. So these two teachers had taken a sabbatical and they didn't want to lose the beach house they had, so they rented it to us in the interim while they were, for the year they were gone. So we lived in Channel Islands, and how, I mean, sand would blow up on the stoop, and I was like, this is heaven. Like, I love it here. I took up surfing. I was out surfing every day. My boss that hired me down in I think it's Woodland Hills or in the valley, he was super flexible with me. So I used to drive down the PCH and go surfing before I'd go to work, you know, rinse off at the beach and then cut across the hills and head into the valley and go to work. And he was totally cool with that. And so I was pretty content. I wasn't making a lot of money. I wasn't a photographer per se, but I was still in the business.
Kind living of. The dream,
yeah.
Somewhat.
Yeah. So, and then my wife was offered a job in Boston with Laura Ashley at the time, their corporate headquarters. It's a UK company, but their corporate headquarters were in Boston. And they paid to move us out there. So it was a great opportunity for her. And I thought, well, we'll get back to the East Coast. Because to me, the East Coast was where all the action was.
Yeah, that's where it was
at. The fashion industry. So I, you know, I was like, yeah, I got on board. And I was like, yeah, let's do it. So she took that job and they moved us to Boston. It was in January 95, maybe. Maybe 95 or 96. It was like one of the coldest winters on.
Yeah, record. So it was from.
I was on the beach one day. I had a beard, you know, a good sized beard, and was a total surfer dude. And then the next day, you know, we were in Boston, and I remember they put us in a corporate apartment off the common. And I walked out of the apartment out onto the common, and my beard went just like froze. Just like, and I was like, this sucks. We can't live here. I hate it. You know, we just left the beach and Southern Cal life. And I was like, I don't know. I just don't
You were
know.
Dying
yeah.
inside.
So anyway, she was, you know, it was a big job for her. So it was a big deal. And so I thought, well, we're going to have to just, I'll have to figure it out. So I took a job as an art director for a kind of a local magazine, a round town type magazine. And then through that job, I was hiring local photographers in Boston to work for me and do some shoots. And I hired a guy, and he said, we became really good friends. And he said, listen, Talbots is hiring. They're looking for a producer. You're perfect for it. You should you know, call, give him a call. He gave me the name of the guy to call. I called him up, and I ended up getting a job as a photo producer for Talbots, which is a women's fashion clothing company at the time. And at that time, back in the mid-90s, they were really popular amongst the conservative women. And it was probably the best job I ever had. I mean, it was awesome. I was in charge of putting together photo shoots, producing all photo shoots, hiring the talent, the models, the hair and makeup, you know, the whole thing, putting together all the travel arrangements. And Talbots had a huge budget. So we used to stay Four Seasons, Ritz-Carlton. We travel all over the Caribbean, Hawaii.
Oh,
stay
awesome.
For months
job.
At a time. And it was just, it was the best job. And I didn't want to leave, but I still had this burning desire to be a photographer, you know, to be my own photographer. And anybody who's been an assistant or been in this business knows how hard it is to kind of make that jump from like assistant to being the shooter, to being the bang guy. And so I kept that job, and the woman that hired me was pregnant at the time, and she was going out on maternity leave. So she kind of gave me a crash course on producing. I mean, I was, a lot of it was familiar to me, but specific to that, the way they did things. And she said, you know, I'm going to go out. So Talbots is super corporate to the point where, you know, if you're a manager, you have a certain desk, a certain pair of scissors, a certain, you know, if you're a supervisor, you have a cubicle, you know, it's very corporate like that. Well, she had an office. So it was a big room with offices all around the room and then cubicles in the center. And I was hired on as a photo, basically at a supervisor level. And I was supposed to get a cubicle, and the woman that hired me was a manager, and she had an office that, with a glass door that looked out onto the cubicles. And she says, just use my office. She didn't care. And neither did I. She's like, just use my office while you're, you know, until I get back, and then we'll figure out where to seat you, because we were on the road most of the time. I mean, 90% of the time we were on the road, we weren't in the office. And so I took her office. Well, my coworker there had the cubicle outside the office, and she just hated that. She hated that I was, you know, I'm the new guy.
Behind
I've got the
glass
office.
Door.
It was horrible. So from the day one, she didn't like me. And I got along with all the crews I worked with. Like, you know, everybody I worked with was super cool. And we used to have a ton of fun and make the trips really fun. And so there was just a lot of tension between the two of us. And what happened is the woman that hired me, she decided not to come back. She decided just to quit while she was out on maternity leave. So her boss, who was managing us, knew that there was kind of some tension between us, her and I, because we used to have to, we didn't work on the same shoots. She would handle certain shoots and I would handle different shoots, but we had to check in with each other when we were out, because usually one of us was in the office when the other one was out, just kind of as an anchor. Again, this is kind of before cell phones and internet. I remember they gave us a phone, and it was a big deal. You know, remember the phones that came in a little suitcase?
Yeah.
And, you know, they were like this big, and you had to dial out. It was, they were like satellite phones or something. And so we were assigned those phones, and like if we were traveling abroad or something, you know, we were supposed to be checking in and stuff. And I used to, like, I didn't think much of it. I was like, well, everything's going great. There's really no reason to call in. But she used to get pretty upset that I wouldn't check in with her and stuff. To make a long story short, we really didn't get along. But we didn't have a boss for quite a while. Once my boss went out on maternity leave, and then she decided to quit. And then the guy who was overseeing both of us knew that there was tension. So he didn't promote anybody, and he didn't hire anybody. He just kind of left us as equals, thinking that that would be better. And finally, after quite a while, they decided we need a supervisor here that's going to anchor the office, and then we'll hire another person. And I wasn't interested in the supervisor. I'd liked being out on the road. And she was perfect. My coworker was perfect for that position. So they promoted her, and then I thought, that was the end of the job. I was like, okay, I'm done. Like, she's going to micromanage me, and I'm gonna,
oh yeah, you saw the writing on the wall. Yeah.
So
her seething animosity.
Yeah. So, but the cool thing about that job was they gave me a corporate credit card, an Amex, and to pay for everything. So when you're on a big photo shoot, you know, you spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on hotels and travel and crew dinners and all that stuff. So I had racked up well over $1 million on this card, and they let me keep the mileage for my personal use. So
all the points on the
all the points on the car. So I had like a million miles or million points on this card to travel and do stuff. So when she got promoted, I was like, you know, I'm gonna take advantage of this. I'm gonna leave. I'm gonna quit and just go all in for my photo career to become a photographer. And my wife was pretty, we were established pretty well in Boston. I said, I'm going to move to Europe, to Spain, and try and work for some Spanish magazines and just finish off my portfolio and make that jump. And I had all this mileage so I could travel back and forth and stuff. So my wife, again, knock on wood, bless her heart, she's like, just do it, go for it. So I moved to Spain. I was living in Madrid, and I started shooting for Spanish magazines.
Wild turns here. Yeah. Now you're in Spain.
Now I'm in Spain. And so I was shooting for Spanish Elle, some other Spanish local regional magazines. I was working on my portfolio. I stayed there almost a year and then came home and immediately was able to start working as a photographer back in Boston. So Boston has a really good photo community, and there was a lot of agencies and big retail clients there.
Yeah.
So
the hub.
Yeah. So when I got back to Boston, one of my first jobs was an ad agency. My first big job shooting Marshalls. You've heard of Marshalls department.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So they hired me to shoot all their like newspaper ads and stuff through the ad agency. And then from that point, the TJX Companies, which owns Marshalls, brought everything in house, and they brought me in house with it. I wasn't working for them full time, but they brought me in and hired me to continue working with them. And it was a huge client. It was big money, and they bought the rights out on all the photos, and so it was a great start to my career.
good action.
You know, I was able to survive and make that jump.
And you were back in Boston with your wife.
Yeah.
That's a beautiful story.
So we ended up staying in Boston 20 years, and I ended up shooting, you know, I've shot for Anthropology, Land's End, J. Jill. Pendleton was a big client of mine for many years. So I was able to make that jump and become a shooter.
Yeah, cool.
So, and then about 10 years ago, we decided, you know, our family's getting older, our parents and stuff, and I've always had an affinity for Flagstaff. I really never wanted to leave Flagstaff. But of course, you know, there was no work here. So
that's a tough place to make a living.
So but all my work at this point in my career has been travel, you know, or working out of rental studios for people and showing up for a couple weeks at a time and then heading home. So I was like, we could live anywhere, you know, why not? Let's go back to Flagstaff. So about 10 or so years ago, we decided, let's just move. So we sold everything. We had built a house in New England, a beautiful house. We sold that and kind of cut ties there and moved back to Flagstaff.
Courageous moves. Yeah. Almost everything I've heard you talk about is you think about there's a lot of courage that goes into making big moves.
You know? Yeah, yeah, it's for sure. It's stressful. You know, it takes a toll too when you make all these big moves too.
Oh yeah,
it takes a toll on your marriage, on your family life, just everything. But I feel like they've all been great decisions. You know, we're here in God's country. I call this God's country, and I love it.
It's a neat community, a neat place to live.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you're still freelance photographer.
Yeah. So I still, I mean, matter of fact, I just shot, For a company recently called Sanmar, and I shot the Eddie Bauer portion of that book. You know, I still take on jobs. One of my big clients up until recently, they're out of business now, but was Sahali. So I'm still shooting. I still shoot, but not. It's not like it used to be, you know.
Well, no, everything changes when you move back to Flagstaff.
Yeah, yeah. So I've kind of, you know, we just do whatever. I mean, we've been fortunate, you know. We've owned some properties and done some good, made some good decisions financially. So it's not the end of the world that I'm, you know, not working every day, but I'm really enjoying my life now here.
Well, and with that, let's segue into what you're doing now with the crafting hats.
Yeah, so a few years back, I took up hat making. My father has always wore cowboy hats and been somewhat of a cowboy in a sense. And he would hand me down his old cowboy hats. And I've collected them over the years. And I actually really love wearing them from time to time. And then in the fashion industry, on photo shoots, a lot of the people I work with are always wearing, you know, cool hats, cowboy hats, yeah, or Western style hats and stuff. And a while back, we were in Santa Fe. I was in a hat shop there in Santa Fe, and I was like, oh man, I'm gonna buy myself a hat. So I bought a really cool hat, and then I thought, I bet I can make one of these, you know. So I thought, I'm gonna check this out. So I took a kind of a crash course. It was like this make your own hat deal, and up in Oregon, and I made a hat, and I came back, and I thought, I think I could do this. I think this would be fun hobby. You know, I wasn't really planning on making it in business, but I thought, I think I can make some hats. I think this would be fun. So I started collecting the equipment and started making a few hats. And before you know it, I was making hats for friends. And then people were asking me for hats. And then, you know, and it slowly turned into a little hat business. So I make these custom, mostly cowboy hats, but I can make any type of hat. 100X beaver hats, made to order. Basically, I size you up and make it to your head.
Well, yeah, and I went to your studio, and it's a number one. I've always worn cowboy hats, and I've had felts. I've had I really in the summer, of course, prefer the palm hats, and you know, classic,
yeah,
style cowboy hats. But that the materials you're using is
it's
next to none.
Yeah,
and it's really top beautiful, of the line. Beautiful,
yeah,
felt.
Yeah, top of the line, and I really enjoy it. I mean, I like working. I've always worked with my hands, so it's really tactile, and the beauty is you're creating something for somebody. It's something they really want.
It's a personal thing, like Tom Landry said, the great coach of the Dallas Cowboys, a hat doesn't make the man, it finishes.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
That's a great thing.
And when people put hats on, it just kind of changes. You can see them kind of like sit up straight, and you know, it's like, oh, this is cool, you know. So it's very satisfying to hand over a hat and get the reaction. And
no, it's really cool too. I was walking downtown, and you have a really super nice display there on San Francisco.
Yeah, down
Street.
At the Artist Gallery. I've got some hats
you've
on
got,
display.
You have a beautiful selection in the window.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
No, it's really cool.
Yeah. I just made a hat for Brad Dimmick,
yeah,
and it's going on the canyon this week. I think he's going down this week, so I'm calling it the Boatman. I'm going to make you a hat. We're going to. I don't know what you want to call it, but we're going to name it after you.
Let's do it.
Yeah.
Let's do it.
Yeah, I can't wait. But yeah, it's
and so as you make more and more hats, do you want to keep the foot on the brake pedal, or are you gonna go ahead and see where it goes?
I want to see where it goes. You know, I'm excited about it. I'd like to make it into a business. You know, or you know, even busier than I am now. You know, it's slowly picking up.
I think that's a great idea too, considering your proximity, because I've always looked around in hat shops and this, that, and the other. And there are few and far between that are really nice custom places that, I mean, they don't have to be affordable for everybody, but to be reasonable consumer product that's custom is really difficult to find.
Yeah, it's rare. And there's not a lot of hat makers in the country. They're kind of few and far between. And
I see it as a niche, big time.
Yeah, it's really a niche craft. But, you know, it's for everybody. I think everybody wears a hat, you know, so wear a hat. I always run into people and they're like, I'm not really a hat maker or hat wearer. And I'm like, yeah, you are. Let me find a hat for you. Yeah. I can make one that
works.
There's
a hat for you.
Yeah.
I'll tell you, there are a lot of really bad hats out there. And I am in a business where everybody's got a hat on with the river business.
Yeah.
And I have seen some of the worst hats. Yeah. You wonder why they put it on the top of their head.
Yeah.
I've seen a few good ones, but there's some bad hats out there.
Yeah.
So I don't think you need to worry about really having to compete with a lot of hats.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. You know, there's a few hat makers here in Arizona, but I think Arizona is a perfect place for it.
It is.
There's a lot of cowboys or that Western idea. You know, we get a lot of...
It's a common style of dress. And it's also, you know, what's left of the Wild West. I mean, if you can't have a cowboy hat, you're not really here.
Yeah.
You know, it's like having at least one pair of boots.
Yeah. And you know what's really cool for me is that I can kind of incorporate my photography. So if you go to my Instagram site or something, you know, I'm only shooting them in black and white, which I'm sure annoys some people because they can't see the colors. But, you know, I take really cool pictures of them. I can do portraits with them.
Right.
And that, I'm working on a project right now with a...
Well, just for the listeners, what is that?
So
site.
Well, I'm working with a guy named Eric Cruz. I hope I didn't ruin your name, Eric. And he's a woodworker, and he does carvings in wood. So what's the idea is Eric approached me, and we're gonna do Faces of Flagstaff is what we're gonna call this project, and basically I'm gonna make a hat. Or take one of my existing hats and do a portrait of people wearing the hat. And then he's going to do a wooden portrait made out of wood of the hat. So I'm I get to do the hat and a black and white portrait. And then he's going to do a wooden portrait. And then we're hoping sometime towards the end of the year here in late November, early December, before the holidays, that we can do a show. Put a show together, so that's
exciting stuff. This community will eat that up. That's hitting a lot of different bells there.
So we're trying to hook up with people like yourself, who's very Flagstaffian and known in the river community and throughout Flagstaff and from afar. You know, I just did Brad Demick with Fretwater Boatworks.
The great boat builder he is. No, that's cool.
So, and then, you know, we're putting together a list of people we'd like to meet and do these work on this with. So,
that's an exciting project to say the least. And, you know, the neat thing I hear is just the power of imagination.
Yeah.
That, you know, this is a great life story that we're getting in on. Today with you in that, you know, you've taken chances and you've chased dreams, and no, it's a uplifting story.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, I'm an average student. I was never a great student. And back in 1999, NAU had their 100-year anniversary. So they picked their top 100 students and had kind of a big celebration. And I got picked to come back for that.
Oh, how exciting.
Which
how
was
are,
super
what a great
exciting.
Honor, yeah.
Yeah, because I wasn't summa cum laude. You know, I was kind of a screw up. And but the moral of the story was I actually spoke at the School of Communications. They invited me to speak at their graduation. And I think that my professors were fascinated that, you know, this kid who had a dream, but maybe wasn't the greatest student, you know, was able to kind of still make it work and become
Well, they
something.
Love that. Yeah. It's the power of education, whether
right.
you're
just
the getting, top of the class or not.
Exactly. So I was a C student, and that was what my whole speech was on. You know, you could be average and still just get through.
Go do something.
Get your degree and just keep on dreaming, keep pursuing your dream. And no matter what anybody tells you, you know, take chances, as you said earlier, and try and, you know, make your dream happen. It can happen.
So. It's a beautiful, and we've just about run out of time, and that's a great way to send this off. And all you guys that are out there, I'm even thinking about enrolling in the fall session of NAU now after this inspirational talk. But you guys chase your dreams.
Your dreams.
Jose, thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian.
And
for
we look
me.
Forward to the next chat.
Yeah.
We'll do that down the road. I've got lots more questions. And I'm sure that everybody that has sat in here with Jose has enjoyed his adventure, which has been a big adventure.
Yes.
And there you got it. Big adventures with Jose and Brian. And you guys take care of yourselves and get the shots. And if it does turn into the third shot, get that one and stay right side up. Cheers.
Big Adventures with Brian Durker is supported by Dave Wegner and dedicated to all the scientists and river community who have worked to protect the Colorado River, Grand Canyon, and its environment. Thank you, Dave, for your support of Big Adventures. Big Adventures is produced by Brian Durker, Margaret Knight, and me, Gavin Bugner. Bill Gleckler and his mandolin provide our music. If you like our show, please subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.